accession number 23329, reel 24.
Kalyunga, reel 24.
Somebody snatched the guard's lantern, and with a little bit of light, some of the men were able to get hold of the horse, which had rather stunned itself in throwing itself against the wall, and they managed to quieten it, and eventually guards did open the door. We could see some of the prisoners patting the horses, soothing them, stroking their noses, and it was a strange sight. Unbelievably, nobody had a broken bone. There were bruises and abrasions, but nobody was really hurt. In the morning, we were told that we wouldn't be marching that day, and from the farmyard, we could see men who'd been quartered elsewhere in the neighbourhood begin their day's slog. One had somehow acquired a broken down pram in which his kit was piled, and he pushed it along comfortably. Column after column straggled past, and long after they'd disappeared, we could hear their voices and the scrape of their boots on the road. In the farmyard, in spite of the vigilance of the sentries, prisoners stole eggs and knocked off the farmers' chickens. Feathers littered the barnyard, and there were spitted birds cooking in the flames of a dozen fires. The poor farmer, leaning on his picket fence, watched very sourly and protested to the guards, who merely shrugged. They had orders to prevent theft, but they hadn't seen any theft. They had no orders to stop prisoners cooking, nor to inquire where the chickens had come from. Rather like the time when we cut up the post in the winter, which I mentioned earlier. But it wasn't only chickens. We could soon smell roast pork, and by that time the farmer couldn't bear to watch any more, and he went indoors. His young pigs were barbecued by his unwelcome guests, who thoroughly enjoyed them. Our four weren't so lucky, or perhaps so brave as the others, but Dick argued with the sentry guarding the piling of potatoes in the barn, while I crawled under a tractor and plundered potatoes from within inches of their feet. I stuffed them into my battle dress blouse. When I couldn't carry any more, I backed out and Dick was able to move away from the guard, who by now was becoming rather threatening. We had to get water from the farmhouse kitchen, and the poor German family had to suffer a continuous stream of English prisoners. They sat around their table in stoical silence, and the prisoners asked politely if they could fill this receptacle or that. One of them said, sorry to bother you, but we were able to get only a boiling fowl. I don't think the farmer could understand what he said. But in German, naturally, he said that he didn't blame the prisoners. They had to eat and drink, and he would certainly claim compensation from the authorities who failed to organize provisions for the prisoners. In the evening, we sat around the fires, and a Feldwebel went from group to group and told us that the next day we would be marching back to Fellingbostel. He left everybody in dead silence. Fellingbostel always seemed like hell at the time, said Toby, but I reckon we'll soon see if I was right, because as sure as God made little pussycats, it's to hell that we're going. It seems an improbable tale, Dick wrote calmly in his diary. More likely, we're going to be murdered. When we set off the next day, rather apprehensive, we realized quite soon that our fears were needless. We felt that our middle-aged guards, elderly guards, some of them, were not the sort of men who were going to carry out murder. Ron, with other sick, had been put on a farm wagon, and he waved to us, and we wondered whether we'd see him again. The guards explained that so many prisoners on the road were interfering with the transport of supplies to German troop concentrations who were preparing to resist the British forces. Those had gone on the day before had actually got clear of the supply routes and went marching for several weeks more. 1,500 of us marched back towards Fellingbostel. We were much more buoyant in spirits now. Nevertheless, we soon wearied, and we had to march in one day distance that we had taken to on the way from the camp, although the route was a little shorter. We became rather straggly. We sort of marched in groups of sixes and sevens, not any longer a homogeneous column. We were very hungry. We craved fat and sugar, and Toby produced a small packet of German fat. Heaven knows where he got it. I started to repeat to myself, Fellingbostel, 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 because I seemed to be able to hardly march, but stumble along to that sort of rhythm. At twilight, we reached the camp, and we were told immediately that there was nowhere to sleep. Thousands of prisoners, many nationalities, had been marching across Germany until the Germans didn't know what to do with them, had been dumped in the camp. Nearly 1,000 Yugoslavs had been on the road for 7 months, and in the bitter winter they had lost many of their numbers. So a shanty town mushroomed on the open ground of the compounds. People found bricks, pieces of wood, even tarpaulins, probably from the German tool sheds, and they put up little square huts. Toby reconnoitred and decided that the woodshed could be cleaned out and made habitable, and we transferred our packs from the De Lausse, where we spent the first night, on the concrete floor. We broke into deep compound where the palliasses that had been taken from us earlier were stored, and also there were double-decker bunks stacked there, and so soon we were quite warmly housed. The guards were still in the guard boxes, standing with their rifles and machine guns, but they watched us cut holes in the fence, and we went to look for food and water. In the camp there were more dried peas, and we took possession of a whole sack. In nearby fields there were potato clamps, and not far away a huge food magazine where there was grain and a store of Turkish dried fruit. The camp water supply had failed, and we had to go half a mile to a web. Toby and I remember, took a large tub, which after queuing for an hour and a half, we managed to fill. Getting it back to the camp was quite a feat. We had to rest frequently until eventually we got to the gap in the fence. When we bent to lift it again, I simply couldn't lift it, and Toby was quite angry and accused me of not trying. He was a stronger man, we did have quite a quarrel. However, Toby waited impatiently, without further criticism, until I was ready to pick up my end of the tub again. When we got back to the woodshed, we found Ron, and he was quite recovered. But by now I was fighting the same complaint, and the diet of peas and potatoes wasn't much help. Some men had managed to get eggs, having foraged rather adventurously in hostile country, or in some cases having bartered with guards. Many were trying to ingratiate themselves by this. Dick, Toby and Ron had each been given an egg by friends, and Dick suggested that I should ask John Holborough for one. John was the 460 squadron shot down the same night and one of the three survivors. And so I went to him diffidently. I don't know how Dick and co. knew that John had some, but anyway, John said he was very sorry, but they weren't his to give away. I heated some water on the open fireplace we'd built, and I took a keg of it to the side of the building where there was a narrow strip of grass, and I stood sluicing my body, and John Holborough walked up and said, "Christ, Cal, you're thin." And while I was dressing, he came back and said, "My friend told me to give you this. Sorry I couldn't when you asked me." I thanked him and rushed outside with the egg, and the others were smiling. "Give it to me," Dick said excitedly. "I'll do it for you. How long shall I give it?" Quite something. So we took it in turns to cook, if boiling potatoes and dried peas could be described as cooking. One midday I was watching some kind of a potage boil and feeling rather down when I heard a song, Tarantella, and I could hear the voice of a trained tenor. It was rather like Josef Schmitz, and I couldn't see the singer, but after Tarantella came "Your Tiny Hand is Frozen," and I saw a young Yugoslav in a tattered uniform appear from behind the woodshed, and he walked across the centre compound until he disappeared in B compound, and he was singing all the way, and I really shivered at the beauty of that voice when all around was so ugly. I looked up and saw a shy Russian standing beside me. There were thousands of them in the camp, mostly Mongols. Right. He smiled when he knew I'd seen him, and he looked towards B compound and then back to me, as if he understood why the singer had so engrossed me. Then he gestured with the box he had in his hands towards the bag of dried peas. So I nodded, and he quickly scooped up handfuls. His visit decided me to go over to C compound, my old compound, where most of the Russians were now quartered, and I walked back into my old room, watched by very curious eyes, and the room had been swept out. Everything seemed neat, but the place swarmed with lice. To the Russians, it must have seemed quite impertinent of me, I suppose, to stroll in and search under their beds, and they didn't understand the gestures by which I was trying to convey that I had lived here and occupied this bed and that I was looking for lost possessions. I didn't find any. But outside the door of the hut there was a pile of rubbish. I turned some of it over with my foot and uncovered the manuscript of a novel I'd been writing. So I brushed the lice from it and also mud that was encrusting some of the pages, and that was all I salvaged out of a mass of work that I did in Germany. On my way back I met Jack Connolly and stopped to have a chat with him. He was the bowler who infuriated the English with his slightly controversial final wicket in the Test match. I asked him how long did he think we'd have to wait for liberation. Oh, Monday morning, he said calmly. And I thought, well, Jack's a schoolmaster. Monday morning is always the new beginning. But on Monday morning, I was peeling potatoes and the 7th Armoured Division was fighting around the camp. The POWs lined the fences, sat up on the posts, and sometimes a tank would crash out of the woods, and the lid would open, and a voice would say, "We won't keep you long," and then they'd be back into the woods again. And those woods had always been so silent, except when the Germans had sung their rounds in the cold mornings. And now they were filled with noise and smoke and flame. I just went on peeling the potatoes. Then armoured cars appeared at the main gate, and the postens, the guards, surrendered their arms to our own camp police. They'd been organised by Dixie Deans several months before. It was one of the several steps he took to give effect to orders received from General Eisenhower. These messages were broadcast in a series of codes at a certain time on a special frequency. Most of the people that Dixie had appointed to the camp police force were still on the march, but there were sufficient back in the camp to create a reasonable little police force. We called them Carter's Coppers, as Captain Bonham Carter had assumed nominal command of the British prisoners in the camp. Obviously he was determined to be senior British officer at some point. As my potatoes started to boil, I found men running past me, all nationalities. None uttered a word. They just rushed for the gate. Their feet, hundreds of feet, just seemed to roar. And I was determined I wasn't going to run with them, but suddenly I found I was doing just that. The armoured cars were surrounded by prisoners cheering and getting autographs from the crews of the cars on scraps of paper, old letters, books. Half a mile away, the war was still going on, and we could hear it on the tank radio. The Germans were resisting in a woodland ambush. A tank was sent. 12 prisoners had been taken. Would somebody come and collect them? This was all on the radio. German senior officers were in flight. They were to be headed off. And then we heard that Stalag 357 had been liberated. But this time it was the crew of the car talking. And the answer was, good show, give them our love. This was a liberation that exactly as we'd imagined it. Somehow I couldn't believe in it. And then a Yugoslav officer rushed forward, and he grabbed the great padlock from the main gate and hurled it on the ground and jumped on it, almost as if it was a living and evil thing. It was very theatrical. I thought how emotional these Continentals were. And then I took from my wallet the penciled map that I'd used to follow the advance of the Allied armies, and I pressed through the crowd to the leading car and obtained the autograph of one Percy Venn from Taunton, Somerset, and the date was April the 16th, 1945. Many years later, I heard that Percy Venn was in Canada, and we were in touch for a little while after that. The bulk, in fact, of the POWs who had not been marched back to Fallingbostel continued on their long march. It was a time when Dixie Deans showed great heroism. Following a shoot-up by six typhoons, when many of the POWs were killed, Dixie not only identified the bodies but helped bury them. The attack occurred at a place called Gressa, and it was the day that they had collected Red Cross parcels from a dump as especially open for them. And Dixie decided enough was enough. He went off with a German, I think he was just a Gefreiter, a corporal, and they cycled right through the lines and got to the British lines, and Deans explained what had happened. He got through to the General Barker and was in time to stop further attacks by our own aircraft on the marching columns. He was given a Mercedes, which had been commandeered, and a Red Cross to fly on the bonnet. He had many adventures which have been well chronicled. When he finally got back to his men, an Australian said, "God, he's performed another miracle. he's turned a bicycle into a Mercedes. They went on and were liberated just about D-Day, I think, by which time I was back in London. While back in Fallingbostel, we had acquired a car of our own. It belonged to the vet in Fallingbostel, but I'm afraid he was probably never saw it again. There was a garage yard where a tank maintenance unit had set up, and there were half a dozen cars there. The German owners had removed some of the mechanism in the hope that the British wouldn't be able to use them, but the mechanics belonging to the tank unit soon got them going. The sergeant in charge said we might as well take one of the cars before they were officially commandeered, and he hated the Germans, and he couldn't understand that we didn't hate. And he said, "They've broken your spirit," and said, "I'm not surprised. I never imagined that they'd keep prisoners in pigsties like that." Oh, I see.